Okay, good evening, everybody. Tonight is March 4th, and it is the, I believe, the 12th in the lecture of this season. The lecture we're doing it on is Moses Mendelssohn. That's who the subject is tonight. Moses Mendelssohn is... In certain respects, he is like a parallel to everything that we've been doing until now, this season. So, coming into the 1700s, the Jewish people as a whole were facing many problems, many issues. We mentioned many of them. In Eastern Europe, there was a, this is post the Chmelnytsky's pogroms, and many of the people were very poor, and the education wasn't making its way there. The learned class that was able to learn, sort of looked down, I guess, in general. I'm not saying everybody, but they were looking down on those that were unlearned, or at least those that were unlearned felt that those that were learned were, the perception was, is that it would be looked down on. It was also a type of learning that was still somewhat prevalent, was very prevalent, and that was the pilpul type of learning, which is like a sort of like a flashy type of learning where you can take, you know, you're learning more what's between the lines than what's on the lines. And with a genius, with a very brilliance, you'd be able to come up with a piece of Torah, but it was not necessarily MS, it was not necessarily true. And then throw in as well, the outside world is becoming very, very more modern. We're going to talk about that now tonight. More, especially in Western Europe, which will eventually make its way to Eastern Europe, is more like a an enlightenment, so to speak, where change in thought, religion, or the chashivas for religion is going down, and people are feeling that they can solve their own problems. They have their own minds and own reason. And the Jews are being, found that they're being in situations that they're A, not used to, and they're, in terms of their own religious convictions, they're being very, it was not strong, and they were not in a good place all over. And as a result, what happened here is there were these movements, so to speak, that were to try to solve the Jewish problem, to help the Jewish people. So the first two that we really met, we spoke about, one we spoke about a lot, and that was the Hasidic movement. The Hasidic movement was really a response. It was an answer to issues that all these people, especially and mainly in Eastern Europe and Poland and Ukraine and Russia, and in that area, it was to give them some life, some chias. It was to give them a feeling of self-worth. They didn't have the opportunity to learn. They were living a miserable physical existence, and now he showed them that your life has meaning, and you can just, you know, with joy in serving Hashem with whatever you could, that's what Hashem wants from you. Do the mitzvahs, but do the mitzvahs with joy, and you know, you have to connect with a tzaddik, because that's where your connection to Hashem is coming from. So you connected with a tzaddik, and he brought you closer to Hashem, and he taught you things, it put you in the right way, and you were able to, even the learning was not as accessible to you, but you were able to serve Hashem by doing mitzvahs. And on the whole, Hasidus was largely very, very, very successful. It accomplished what it wanted to accomplish. Hasidus, throughout the next 100, 150 years is going to go through a few changes, depending on where the Hasidus was. Was it in Eastern, was it in the Ukraine or in South Poland, or was it in the Lithuania or North Russia, or was it even in Hungary and Austria? And what the Hasidic courts, the Rebbes, did, they had to sort of adapt or put stresses on areas that they felt that their Hasidim needed. But that was large, and we spoke about this, at least we spoke about like the first, you know, generation of Hasidim. We spoke about the Baal Shem Tov and how he started it. We spoke about the Maggid of Meserich, who was the organizer, and he sent out all his students, I guess like missionizing, so to speak, if you'd like to call it that way, and bringing people closer to Hasidism. And we spoke a few of the Talmidim of the Maggid of Meserich, and each, all of these people were very, very unique and special people in their own way. The last one we did was Reb Shlomo Zalman, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he at some point was like sort of the spokesman or the leader of all the Hasidim. He wasn't like in charge of anybody, but he was like the representative or the lightning rod for all attacks. You know, he was maybe the most visible. And that was the Hasidic movement that we went through, and that took us also to the beginning of the 1800s. We then spoke about, for the last two periods, we talked about the Vilna Gaon, the Gra. And what the Gra did is, the Gra also, he changed learning, so to speak. He changed the focus of learning. And instead of learning Pilpul, like it was very popular. Again, just to say for Pilpul, we spoke about the learning of Pilpul for a few years ago. And what Pilpul served as purpose when the Jews were first coming to Poland, it was an exciting type of a learning, and it drew in many, many, many people for learning. And it was just the amount of learning that was being done in Poland at the time, until the uprising, until 1648, the uprising of Chmielnicki, was maybe able to say even there was not so much learning since the Chorban Bayis Sheni. But it was a tremendous amount of learning. The descriptions of the time was really, really amazing. But Pilpul, either it also morphed into something which became extreme, or it didn't wasn't talking to the masses anymore. And when the Vilna Gaon came about, we spoke about for the last two times, he was very scientific in his learning, very scientific. He would take the text and he would scientifically break it down. You have to first know Tanakh well, and then the Mishnayos, and then the Gemara, and then you go into the Mefarshim, and it was his learning was a search for the truth. His Talmidim, and he had many, many Talmidim. I think we have a list of over 50 Talmidim, and each of these Talmidim were, you know, just above the average for sure. The leader of them was Reb Chaim Volozhin, and Reb Chaim Volozhin was the one that started a yeshiva, which is the prototype of all the yeshivas today. Every yeshiva that we have today all stems from the structure of Reb Chaim Volozhin's yeshiva. Now again, there were always yeshivas throughout the generations, and since Moshe Mesinai, there's always been a yeshiva. But the way the setup is one base medrash, and all the boys learning the same thing, and shiurim with rebbeim and eating, and this, everything, the way the curriculum and the structure, that was all created from Reb Chaim Volozhin, and he was the one that best understood the Vilna Gaon. And this the Lashon Yeshiva is, like I said, called the Eima Yeshiva, is because all of the yeshivas that are gonna come, that are here today, all stemmed from the Lashon Yeshiva. The Rashi yeshivas of every single yeshiva all came from the Lashon Yeshiva. If the Rosh Yeshiva himself didn't come, but his the Rebbeim came. I said maybe, I think maybe one exception would have been the Chassam Sofer's yeshiva. That was in Hungary anyway. It wasn't, it was more Central Europe as opposed to Eastern Europe, but all Eastern European yeshivas and all the yeshivas that we have now all came from the Gra.
What was going on in Eretz Yisrael?
I'm sorry?
What was going on in Eretz Yisrael?
Eretz Yisrael at the time was relatively nothing. Okay, there was, as a matter of fact, there was not even an official Ashkenazic community. Like we mentioned before, the Ashkenazim in Israel, they weren't even allowed to settle unless they paid the debts from the last Ashkenazic movement that just fell apart and owed a lot of money. It was the Talmidim of the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, that in fact started the Ashkenazic Yeshuv in the 1830s, 1840s, and the yeshivas, you're right, today the yeshivas are all supplanted from the Volozhin Yeshiva. And they come from all over, and that's where we are today. So this was a second, we didn't talk about this yet, but most likely next year, I don't think we'll get to it next week, maybe, but along with the learning, it was also an issue of midos, of Musar, and that's going to be started. It's going within the yeshiva movement. Actually, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is going to start a Musar movement, which is going to complement the yeshiva movement. It's going to go hand in hand. So you have the learning, and then you have the Musar together. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter wanted the Musar movement to be in and of itself. You know, just a movement in yeshivas, out of yeshivas, for everybody. But it didn't catch on like it did in the yeshivas. So, yes, we all are familiar with Musar, and everybody learns Musar, but the Musar movement as a movement was really attached to the yeshivas. Okay, so the Vilna Gaon's, his mahalach, how to bring the Jews out of the situation that they were in, was through the yeshivas. So the yeshivas strengthened, and it had influence on its students, which had influence on the neighborhoods, which had influence on the balabatim and the people that were the neighbors. And that's how the Torah, the yeshiva movement also has, even to today, the yeshivas today are a strong influence on the Jewish community.
So how does the Sephardic community coexist with they have their own yeshiva system, or are they part of?
Yes, that's a great question. What about the Sephardim today? The Sephardim did not develop like the Ashkenazim developed. The Ashkenazim developed, I guess, like more out of need. They were pushed up against the wall. They were like fighting for their survival. The forces in Europe, which are much greater and stronger and more virulent and vicious, and the response had to be stronger in Europe. And whereas the Sephardim, again, overall, and again, I'm not, but overall, in general, the Sephardic countries under the Muslims, things were not, as moving as quickly. Modernization was not as much. They were not the leaders of the world, imperialistic leaders, and therefore there are yeshivas and there are gedolim among the Sephardim, but it did not develop these two movements, and the third movement we're going to be talking about tonight did not develop from in the Sephardim like it did.
So if you go to Flatbush or Borough Park today, it's like kind of related to Sephardim, it's Ashkenazic.
There are Sephardic yeshivas, especially in Eretz Yisrael. You go to yeshivas that are Sephardim, but my understanding is that overall they borrowed from the Ashkenazic yeshiva system.
Or they're part of those systems.
Or they're part within the yeshiva system, right? That's right. So who knows? They did have, at one point, they had, let's say, in terms of halacha, after the 1500s, when they were expelled from Spain, many of them ended up, first of all, if you ended up under the Turkish Empire, under the Ottoman Empire, you were set, because the Ottoman Empire was very pro-Jews. Mm-hmm. It was very helpful. Hashem gave the place for them to get. The problem is at the time they were halfway across the world. It was very difficult for Jews to get to the Ottoman Empire. But those Jews that made it there, they flourished. And like the Beis Yosef, he started in Turkey, in Asia Minor, and then this whole group ended up in Sfat. And that's where Kabbalah developed, and the Halacha, the Shulchan Aruch developed. And we spoke about the Shulchan Aruch going back to the Ashkenazim, and it seemed that even when the Beis Yosef made the Shulchan Aruch, that was it. There was nothing more to argue. That was the Halacha. But when it got to the Ashkenazim, that's and the debates and the fine-tuning, generation after generation of Halacha just kept within the Ashkenazic to develop.
In the Sephardic world, though, it's not unusual to go to like Chaim Berlin and a third of them might be Sephardic.
Could be. In Eretz Yisrael, I think Sephardim, if they're not the majority of from Jews, majority of Israelis are still most likely Sephardim. I don't know in terms of the from and the not from, but they also have their yeshivas. But I think their yeshivas are more, they become Ashkenized.
Huh.
You know, just,
systematic.
I always, it was, you know, the Ashkenazim would, you know, they're very, forceful.
It's not that, it's that a lot of the Sephardim, the largest majority of Sephardim is Moroccan.
Okay.
And Moroccans do a lot of things with the Ashkenazim.
Okay. So let's put it, this is not really about Sephardim, but this is, it's something to look into in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to just, okay, one, yeah.
Just last thing about the pillar pool. It sounds like what this new version of the Shiva came to address was that the pillar pool sounds almost like full contact learning. Like it was more like fighting and yelling and arguing. And you said it was coming up with outrageous, like, theoretical arguments.
There are always arguments in Shiva.
Right.
And you have I don't know if that was the arguments, was more in Popol that were out of hand than not.
Okay.
But what it was is more what's between the lines and trying to make splits that not necessarily were there to try to answer a question that may not have been so direct. You make up a question and now you're making up splits to come along and answer such a question. That would not have been so uncommon. The only thing is if you're not already there, then like you're telling me, you're trying to tell me something theoretical when you don't even know the basics. And that's what the Gra and his learning changed. And the yeshiva world really changed the type of learning. So our yeshivas all basically follow the system of the Gra. And then the Musar also complemented it tremendously. You have the learning and the Musar. There was also another stream, and that's really what we wanted to get to today. And the other stream is, how do you deal with the Jews? The Jews are in a very precarious, and what do you do? How do you? And this, the other stream, what eventually would become in the West, would become into Reform Judaism. And in the East, it would take on the form of enlightenment, so or Haskalah. So that's another way, another approach that the Jewish people took to deal with the Jewish issues of Jews, like not, you know, they're not part of the Jewish society. They were basically poor and they didn't know too much learning. What do you do with them? How do you deal with them? So Moses Mendelssohn was more, his this approach was more like an assimilation type of an approach.
When did he live?
He was born, again, we'll just see over here. He was born, I believe, in 1729, I think, about 1730. And I think he passed away in the 1780-something. So he didn't live that long, but, okay, so he, maybe I have it on one of these slides.
Okay.
So, but his approach was, and the reason, he was, first of all, a genius. Okay, that's one thing. And, but his approach was, is he was a religious Jew. Outwardly, he could say, I guess he wore the yarmulke, and he was religious Jew. For sure, in his mind, he was 100% practicing Jew. Okay, he writes in his letters that he was the emperor was. He had a meeting with the emperor, and he didn't daven mincha. You know, so like before he went in, he spent a few minutes. He davened mincha quickly, and then went in. The emperor was very upset with him. Like you know, I ain't waiting. So, but you know, he writes in his memoirs like I never missed mincha before. So he was someone that was able to somehow be accepted in the non-Jewish world, and he was able to somehow keep being a practicing religious Jew. The only thing is that it didn't end well with Mendelssohn and those that followed him. And I guess the one line before I guess we see the one. You know, explanation of all this. His children and grandchildren, you know, converted to Christianity. He had like six kids, and of the six, four converted to Christianity, two didn't. And of his grandchildren, all of his grandchildren converted to Christianity except for one.
Mm.
So, like, why? And a lot of it had to do with his personal beliefs. It wasn't like what me and you believe. And for me, it was just a little, I'm trying to go through the material and try to find out exactly, like, I don't exactly know what he believed, but we'll try to get, you'll see from some of the things that he wrote and what he did, you could see that he was definitely off, and you could see where Reform Judaism got their, either their inspiration or their ideas from. Okay, Reform Judaism I think in the next 50 years is going to sweep the boards. I think in the next 50, 70 years, I think 90% of Jews in Germany will have converted to Christianity or for sure not be practicing Jews.
Oy, oy, oy.
Okay, it's devastating. When
now?
When
no,
no, not now, but when Rav Shamshel Raphael Hirsch came and he created a community, there was, I don't think his community ever was more than 8 or 10,000 people. It was just like a relatively small community, and that community is amazing what he did. He was able to take the best of everything. He did it. He was able to put it all together. I guess maybe what Mendelssohn thought he could do, or Shamshel Raphael Hirsch did. And that's why. And then again, also these ideas by the time it swept to the east, so it took on a different form. In the west, just again overall, in the west it looked different than in the east, and because it's the west where people were more civilized and cultured, and the Jews there would not mind looking like those non-Jews. And you know, they were seeing that they were cultured, and so the assimilation there would be, it took on one way. But when it got to the east, and you're talking about the Polish peasant and the Russian peasant, and the Jews looked down on them. We don't want to be like them. So the secularization took form of a haskalah, like a different type. Not that we want to be like them, but we don't want to be like I am, but we want certain acceptance, and we could be Jewish but not religious, and instead of the religion different types of stresses, whether in the first generation it would be, let's say, languages, a Yiddish Haskalah or a Russian or a Hebrew Haskalah. And then later on it took into Bund and socialists and communists, all these different Haskalahs. And it would have all gone. I get, I'm really getting ahead of myself here. And it would all gone, it would have been nothing, it would have been over with, except for one thing. It was all taken and revived and transplanted through Zionism. So Zionism took all of these Haskalahs and brought it with it then to Eretz Yisrael. So I'm talking a secular Zionism. But that in and of itself, now we're getting like really ahead.
What period are we talking about, 1800s?
Yeah, we're talking about the... We're talking now about, well, Moses Mendelssohn is the late 1700s, but the reform is, you know, and Haskalah is going to start in the late 1700s and into the
1800s. When did Samson Raphael Hirsch?
Well, so 1830s?
Middle
1800s. Middle
1800s.
1850s. Okay, now let's see Moses Mendelssohn. What did he start? He actually started in a city called Dessau. And he had a Rebbe, he was a firm boy. He lived in Dessau and he had a Rebbe, his name is David Frankel. David Frankel was the author of the Karban Eda in the Yerushalmi. I mean, he was a big Talmud Chacham. He wrote the Pirush that we have in the Yerushalmi called the Karban Eda, and that was Moses Mendelssohn's Rebbe. And he was his Rebbe until he was about 13, 14, and then he was called, David Frankel, Rav Frankel was called to Berlin. And shortly after, Moses Mendelssohn followed him. Now, I think he followed him there. It sounded like he followed him because he wanted to be part of his yeshiva to continue learning with him. But once he got to Berlin, he came into contact with a lot of Jews, secularized Jews, and they taught him lots of many things, different philosophies and things. There's a Polish Jew, Israel Zamos, taught in mathematics. He learned a lot himself. Again, he was a genius. It says over there somehow one day he got a hold of the Rambam's Moreh Nevuchim, which is his philosophy. You're trying to fit. It doesn't speak to us, Moreh Nevuchim. That's why it's, you know. But Moreh Nevuchim really is trying to fit the Torah into Aristotelian thought, fit it with Aristotle. In the Rambam's time, Aristotle was it, and the Muslims had somebody that fit Islam into Aristotle, and the Christians had somebody that fit Christianity and the people around in the Muslim lands that had to deal with these Goyim said to the Rambam, could you do something for us? And he wrote the Moreh Nevuchim. When the Moreh Nevuchim hit Ashkenaz, when it hit Europe, it was they didn't understand it. What are you doing? What are you taking out Torah and comparing it or trying to fit into some philosopher Aristotle? And it caused tremendous, tremendous fights and arguments. So he found this Moreh Nevuchim. He was taught English in French, and he, as soon as he learned Latin, he got a copy of John Locke's An Essay Concerning Human Understanding, just to show you what he was. And he got himself a Latin dictionary, a German Latin dictionary, and that's how he went through John Locke's book that was written in Latin. You know, by every time he came to a word, he looked in the dictionary, and that's how he got through that. In 1750, he became a person by the name of Isaac Bernhard. He was the first a Malami to his children, and then he basically became his bookkeeper and actually became his partner. That's how he made his money, but that's not how he became famous. He became Just so you just know what Moses Mendelssohn, you'll see what he did. His accomplishments are astounding, especially in the fact where you have like, these were some of the rules, laws that were passed, that were active in Germany at the time. So So this was the Merchant Guild in Berlin, issued in 1716 and still in force 1802. So during the full life of Moses Mendelssohn, this is what the guild wrote. Inasmuch as the Merchant Guild in Berlin is to be composed of honest and honorable persons, the following must be barred from membership. Jews, homicides, murderers, thieves, perjurers, adulterers, or any other person afflicted with great public vices or sins. Okay, and that's how, of course, therefore, any of the above cannot be part of our guild. So you see the prejudice against the Jews was out. Also, the Berlin Academy of Music, a Jew wanted to apply to the Berlin Academy of Music in 1795, and they wrote, it is mathematically impossible that a Jew could be a composer. Okay, and therefore they rejected him. By the way, there is a Moses Mendelssohn's grandson, right? Felix Mendelssohn. He actually converted to Christianity, but he was a very, very big famous composer. Just I guess it was after 1795.
Oh,
he wasn't a Jew anymore.
It's the same name. It's the same family.
Yeah, grandson. Moses Mendelssohn's grandson.
Let
the
Jews know about music.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what happened here is, what got himself prominence is there was a competition to put out something on metaphysics, mathematical proofs to metaphysics. And he wrote this paper on evidence in the metaphysical sciences. Now, you have to realize, in this competition, there were two people, I guess if you're in sociologists or philosophers, you would know these names, but among the competitors was Thomas Abbott and Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant came in second. So Moses Mendelssohn, in this thesis that he wrote, was the winner of this thesis of this paper, and it got him tremendous recognition. In October, this was in 56, 59, October in 63, this is also huge. The king granted Mendelssohn, but not his wife or children, the privilege of protected Jew, which assured him the right to live to undisturbed residence in Berlin. Also, you get to see that every Jew that was in Berlin, technically, it could have been just thrown out at any second and every day.
Germany had such anti-Semitism already.
Yeah,
hundreds of years before what we know.
Germany, all of Europe.
A lot of the Nazi stuff, they just copied stuff from Protestant. What's his name?
Martin Luther.
Martin Luther. Martin Luther, once he realized the Jews weren't going to follow him, he wrote the most brilliant anti-Semitic stuff, and it was just, it was back then.
So even though the Jews evolved in Germany and professors and mathematicians and stuff, but the underlying plot was always there.
Yeah, it was there. It was under there. It was all right.
But that's also what we do. When you say no, we go yes.
Okay, this is something else. There was so on this, Mendelssohn, when he had his correspondence with Abt, which is one of these philosophers, he decided to write this, and this got him like instant fame. I mean, he wrote a paper called Fadan, okay, and it's really called On the Immortality of the Soul. And when he wrote this, this became the most popularly read book in Germany. It was about the immortality of the soul, that when a person dies, he's still the soul, the neshama, is still there. And what he did is he fashioned it after, I think Phaedon is also, there was Plato, I think, also had a philosophical work by that name, and he used the same style as Plato did, and he just, the dialogue, and he just updated it for what he needed, and it was such a hit. Like, it said that anybody who came to, he was known as the German Plato or Socrates, anybody who came to Germany who was, let's say, of royalty from other, one of the stops were to meet this philosopher. He was just unbelievable what his brilliance and what he was able to show and prove.
So they made him a media star.
Right. Now, what happened on this, they actually, because of this book, they gave him a medal. They made an impression of a medal to give to him. So when they gave him the medal, they didn't know too much about him. You know, they had a medal with his likeness on one side and a skull on the back because of Feydan. It was like a, but it was such a tremendous achievement. No, it was like, you know, he got the attention of the emperor. He was there, and again, he was a firm Jew. You know, and that was, I guess, part of the mistake, the facade, that if he did it, everybody else can do it. And I guess he was the exception. But, so they asked him, they asked the one who wrote, who was making this medal, so they asked him for a biography of himself, because they didn't know who he was. And here you get to see his own, he always was very gracious and he always was very humble. Also to say for him, he didn't think of himself so like, you know, I'm better than you and everything. And he was kind to other people, right? Maybe that's what he was. He was a kind person. He was, he would talk to many people. People would come, but that's what it was. So in his letter to Yochanan and Jacob Spies, pastor, librarian, and supervisor of the Mint in Ansbach, who had a medal struck in Mendelssohn's honor in 1779. Okay, so now, this is his letter. He asked him, please, with your medal, when they wanted to put the medal up in front, or they wanted people to read about Mendelssohn, give us something about yourself. And this is what he writes. I cannot promise you, readers, that the circumstances of my life, which really are of little consequence, he didn't even care, he didn't even know details. I mean, it just wasn't, you know, will prove particularly entertaining to them. You see, he wrote very well also. My biographical data has actually always seemed so unimportant to me that I never bothered to keep a record of them. The main facts that I can recall offhand are approximately as follows. I was born in the year 1729, 12th of Elul, according to the Jewish calendar in Dessau, where my father was a teacher and a Torah scribe. I studied Talmud under Rabbi David Frankel around 1743. I followed him, he went to Berlin, and I followed him that same year. Here I developed a taste for the arts and sciences as a result of my acquaintances with as well as some instruction by Mr. Aaron Gumpert, who later became a doctor of medicine, and he died a few years ago in Hamburg. Eventually I became first a tutor in the house of a rich Jew, Isaac Bernhard, later as bookkeeper and finally manager of a silk factory, a position which I am still holding. I was married in my 33rd year, sorry, 7 children, of whom 5 survived, okay, I said 6 to 5. Incidentally, I never attended a university. Now, it just goes to show you what he did, nor did I ever listen to an academic lecture. This lack of formal education constituted one of my greatest difficulties, for it meant a real struggle to get an education solely by my own efforts and diligence. So he did what everybody else did without going to yeshiva. Yeah, okay. Could be. In fact, I overdid it. And the overzealousness by which I pursued my studies bore on a nervous weakness that renders me all but incapable of any scholarly occupation. So he had a curvature of his back, which he claimed it came because of studying all those hours bent over looking over the Morning Ruhm. That's what he says in that. He says, but the joy I got from it overcame all these physical things that I had. Okay, so you see, I mean, he's a brilliant person and accomplished a lot. So what now is, he's thrown into a world that's what is, they believe themselves as an age of reason, enlightenment. And what is that? Basically, it really means that you use your own reason to find everything out. You know, religion is now being cast as old and archaic and dark. And the reason why they listen to these rabbis who don't know what they're talking about, they just, you know, they're stuck in their old mindset, but we, the new, the modern, and our thinking, oh, we can now, we know better, basically. And Moses Mendelssohn was of that mindset as well. Okay, so that's where he started going off. And if you have your own mindset, and he's actually going to say that, really say this, then, you know, then the next person, people have their own mindset.
This is Kant saying that.
Right, so this is Kant, right. So this is just a little bit of a definition. Enlightenment is the man's release from his self-incurred tutelage. Tutelage is man's inability to make use of his capacity to use his reason without outside direction. Think for yourself, basically. Self-incurred is this tutelage when it's caused by not an inability to employ our faculty to use our reason, but a lack of resolution and of courage to use it without outside direction. In other words, don't be afraid to think by yourself, and if you come up with something different than everybody else, so be it.
How ironic that in today's world of universities, you're not allowed to have any thought outside of what they tell
okay,
you.
Okay, okay, so we've come full circle. Right. So we, if anything, it's such a minor, but you happen to be
it's
right.
Not
right. Moses Mendelssohn, this is a person by the name of Lessing. He was also a big writer. He became a non-Jew, but Mendelssohn and Lessing were lifelong friends. Very, very close. And they were very complimenting each other. And Lessing wrote about Moses Mendelssohn's integrity and philosophical mind made me anticipate him a second Spinoza, lacking only in the errors to be his equal. And I suppose he's made mistakes, and I don't think Mendelssohn will make those mistakes. Okay, so this is now we're going to see things the way Mosesson thought things, and I think that really was part of his issue, is that he felt that, you know, the Torah is not where you get your reason from, thought from, but you think of it on your own. He writes, I place my full and unreserved trust in Hashem, who in his omnipotence could endow man with the faculty to discover for himself, independent of the dictum of the authority, those truths that constitute the basis for human salvation. Okay, so basically I can't prove it, but I know that Hashem has given me the ability to get the truth by my own thinking. I'm like, well, what about the Torah? You have a Torah, but that's not what he thought the Torah basically was. He thought it all came, and I believe that Hashem has given me and everybody else that ability.
Did he go to shul? Did he daven?
Yes.
No?
Yeah, he did. Went to shul. He davened. Yeah. I don't know if he went to shul and where he was, but
he believed in God. But
he believed in God, and he davened. And you'll see how he talks about holidays. It's just for him, it wasn't like reasoned, and it wasn't, you know, he just had harsh things to say about it. Okay, and again, this is back in Phaedon, which we mentioned, that he believed the soul exists, and yes, there is a neshama, and you'll get to the real truth after life. In a human body, you're stuck and can't get the full truth, but after a person passes away, that's when the real truth will come. Again, this is like a little hard for me because I'm trying to figure out what he holds. I really don't understand his age of reason.
Is he disregarding Tanakh and Talmud?
No, so Tanakh and Talmud, he doesn't view it like me, like we do it, that our source is godly and full of reason, but he views it as it's a religious way of living. A religious way of life, you know, with nice inspiration to draw from. But not that it's filled with reason. Reason comes from the modern man. I believe that Hashem, you know, and the Torah was given from Hashem, but not, you know, it's just a way of living, a way of life.
He was arrogant. He may have been humble in his
His thoughts, okay.
But at the end of the day, he believed in God, but he believed that God made him know all that he needs to know without his direction. The authority he didn't take was God's authority. He believed that no authority except his own mind.
Exactly. But he thought that that's what God wanted him to do. Okay.
Right. So
it also, just in a, this is a comment that he had with Thomas Abbott. So he does talk about the his idea of free will, which seemingly is pretty decent. In a world where everything would be meticulously arranged according to the notions of divine justice, basically, if there's no, if everything is, if there's no midas harachamim and everything is din, and then you, the world as we know it wouldn't exist. I think he got this right. You know, there would be no possibility of free will, and there's no possibility of
doing
obsessed with anybody else.
That's
basically, so he did hold that. Now he did go ahead and help his people. Whenever anybody, if there was any way that he can write a letter and help a community, that's what he did. It was a, he writes about expulsion. This is a letter to Camerat, a high official in Dresden. So again, the Jews in Dresden, I believe, were threatened with expulsion. So he wrote, "It's not possible that under the reign of the best and most charitable prince and under the administration of wise and sympathetic men, such punishment could be meted out to people who committed no crime. Nor can I believe that the guiltless and poverty-stricken, regardless of their appearance or religious beliefs and practices, will be denied the fire of earth, water, and shelter." I was even like, okay, so these people, they don't look nice. They're old, they're archaic, they look, you know, whatever, but still, what they do wrong? Just because they have a different religious belief, you're going to expel them?
Privy Council.
Yeah. Again, this is, I just want to see what this one. Okay, another thing he did is, we spoke about him in an earlier work, Menashe ben Yisrael. Menashe ben Yisrael was the rabbi in Holland. And he was the one that advocated. He went to Oliver Cromwell, I don't know if you remember. He was trying to get the Jews. The Jews had been banished, expelled from England and not allowed back. And Menashe ben Israel was trying to advocate to Oliver Cromwell to let them get back in. And one of the things, he was really successful, but he didn't know until after he passed away. Mm-hmm. And it was a good thing that Oliver Cromwell did not say yes, because as he said yes, when he was killed and taken over, the king came back. The king would have said no. Oh, if Oliver Cromwell said yes, I'm saying no. So mm-hmm. Oliver Cromwell just said, you know, just, I'm not saying yes or no, just the Jews, let them come back. And that really worked. You see how Hashem runs the world. That, mm-hmm. you know, and then, therefore the king didn't have to say no, you have to leave, because Oliver Cromwell said yes. Oliver Cromwell never said yes.
Right.
And therefore when the king came over, the Jews were just there, so they continued there. But Menashe ben Yisrael, he wrote very, very positive things about the Jewish people and how they should be part of society. And Mendelssohn translated this into German. I'm just looking at the time, so I think I'm just going to move here. Just if you just want a few. "We're judged incapable of pursuing the arts and sciences or applying for useful trade. Above all, we're rejected as unsuited to serve in the army or hold government offices, owing to our impunity, uncontrolled penitent for cheating, usury, and lawlessness. These more recent charges now have taken the place of the earlier cruder accusations as justification for our exclusion from the ranks of useful citizens." See, back then it was because we killed gods.
Right.
You know, we killed Yashka, and that's what they're for, you know, but that doesn't go anymore because people were not as religious in Europe. But what was the reason now? Because we are cheats and usury, but the fact that we're too stiff-necked and to let ourselves be converted and attribute us with the depraved monsters that we are, or any abominations that might expose us to the hatred and contempt of all mankind. They basically, and then he ends up saying, they tie our hands, and then people continue to keep us away from every contact with the arts and sciences or from engaging in useful trades and occupations. They bar all roads leading to increased usefulness, and then use our lack of culture to justify our continued oppression. They tie our hands and then reproach us for not using them.
That's the key.
That's basically, and that's what he wanted from there. Okay, here's another thing is supposed to, like they wanted the Germans to say, okay, if the Germans, they got rid of the Besdin, and they wanted the German courts to, we'll paskin according to Jewish law, but you come to our German courts. So now you have to make a shvua, you know, you have to swear, I solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, right? So they wanted to come up with a girsa for the Jews to swear in the non-Jewish courts. So what was it going to be? What language is it going to be? What should it be?
Yiddish.
Huh? Yiddish, right? Yiddish. So for whatever, not for whatever reason, but Moses Mendelssohn was very against Yiddish. And he held that Yiddish is what the reasons why the Jews were all backwards and they weren't cultured. Because Yiddish is a mishmash of a language. It's not a pure, beautiful language. It's a jargon, it's a mix-up, and you know, it's a... And he held that it should either be, that's basically what he says over here, he says that either it should be all Hebrew or all German, or you could use either or, whatever's better, but not Yiddish. That's what he held over here. Okay, this is okay. What happened here? Okay, now he got into a very debate with a Johann Caspar Lavater. Okay, and basically he first wanted to know what Mendelssohn's views on Christianity was, and then about a few years later he came back and attacked him on it. And then Mendelssohn had to publicly or just privately debate him or just write back to him. It drained him that he had to deal with it, seeing that he didn't want to. The relations between the two were strained. Okay, this Lavater, because Lavater was really attacking him, and he was always defending the Jews and the Jewish religion. But there was one time that in 1775, the Swiss-German Jews, I think it was in Kensington, was faced with the threat of expulsion, and Mendelssohn actually sent a letter to Lavater. Please, could you do something about stopping the Jews from being expelled? And he did. He helped them. Lavater, in the enlightened age of reason, I guess he was able to, even though they disagreed, there wasn't like real friendship, they were like a little bit of ill will on both sides, but Lavater did help. By the way, I think it was in this place. Does anybody know why Aleinu we sing? Well, now, why do we sing up until the parentheses?
Right.
We don't sing the rest of it. Why? Now, in the schools now, I have a song I sing, we sing the whole thing.
Right.
But why up until the parentheses?
Because the Christians would kill us.
This is right over here. No, in 1775. What was happening is that the two, there was this one line, Shehem Ishtachavim Lehebel Barik, they bow down to nothing. Shehem Ishtachavim Lehebel Barik, and Mispalim El Yoshia, they follow the gods that don't help. So the Christians took exception to that. And what they used to do is, now we don't mean, we could argue it never meant Christians. Because if they're davening to God, even if it's an imperfect God with three parts, for a guy that may not be Avodah Zarah, for a Jew it is. For a Jew that believes in Christianity would be Avodah Zarah, because
right.
Hashem can't have any forms, but guy it could be fine. But if they're davening to God, that's not our problem. That's what we want. It's the real Avodah Zarah, you know, Hindus and Buddhists, you know, that's the real, that's what we're talking about. It could be Yoshua, but no, I'm not sure. But it's way, way back we have it. So the question is, they used to keep a person there, a government official, in the shul to listen. So what they did is, what they would do is, they would sing the first part of Aleinu. And then after, once they said, right, and that's it. When they know, but you passed the pasuk already.
Right.
So there's no reason to sing the rest of Aleinu. And that's why we only sing until that part. Huh? We don't sing the rest of it. Now, okay, and that's where that this comes from.
We still skip the line.
We
still skip the line because it comes before and after the chorus.
Well, if you sing the song,
when
I sing the boy Shehem Shachavim Lehebel Barikum Spalim Lehishia about Achmukar, I say it.
Right.
You know, and they also I remember reading in the Mishnah Berurah brings down the Gemara says, In Elena and Shmona Esrei, definitely saved. You know, in the Muslim Shmona Esrei, when you're saying Elena, you never want to take change anything, right?
Well, I'm thinking that when I went to conservative synagogues, I don't even be able to have a line.
Okay, could be.
And no parentheses, just not there.
Okay, I'm just. Okay, now I just want. I think maybe you'll just get an idea on how he viewed his own religion. Again, yes, he was very into Tanakh, and he learned as a scholar. He did learn Gemara, but there were things that he just like as a in his rational mind. Now he takes his rational poetry and the beauty. Actually, we said before, he actually criticized the emperor's poetry. So I mean, like maybe 100, 200 years earlier, would have gotten them executed, but here they. The emperor took it he took it in good faith, whatever. But here, I'm sure you will treat the Psalms as poetry and not pay attention to the prophetic and mystical element with which Christians as well as Jewish interpreters have found in them, only because they search for these elements. And as he's saying, the Jews, the rabbis search for meaning of prophecy and only because they searched for these elements, having searched for these elements only because they were neither philosophers or literary critics. This is a time when Bible criticism was very, we know Hebrew and we can tell you what's right and wrong. Same idea. As regards to many of these Psalms, I must admit that I simply did not understand them. The ones I find easiest to understand include many, which I must class as very mediocre pieces of poetry. This is how he's talking about Tehillim. Incoherent verses, repetitions of the same idea ad nauseum, and abrupt transitions and modulations which amount no inspiration could justify. I don't have to go further. But that's the way he's looking at Tehillim. Not that there's any kedusha behind it, not that it's something to connect you with Hashem. Every word in Hebrew means something different. He wasn't... there are subtleties that you can gain, but that wasn't his thing. It's poetry, nothing more than that. And as poetry, it's not very poetic, right? That's really what he wrote about.
He didn't hold it for he didn't hold it Nebuah.
Of course, well.
There was no such thing of Nebuah.
That's a great question. He for sure, that was, Tehillim for sure was not divinely inspired. It was not written with Ruach HaKodesh. Tehillim was poetry of David HaMelech, and he said it was lousy poetry, basically. For poetry, it's lousy. Come on, what do you call this poetry?
In all the prophets, he didn't hold by the prophets.
I don't know. It does. He did believe the Torah was given on Sinai. Yes, he did believe. It was given. It was the Torah of Sinai.
But our Tanakh is all...
Okay, so maybe Tanakh was Nebuah, but there was something to it.
He said it's poetry in the writings of man.
I guess... You see the way he holds of Tanakh, of Tehillim. So again, I don't exactly know what was totally in his mindset, but I'm just showing you a piece of what he wrote.
He himself wrote
about Tehillim. But he's using his rational mind, and I think he also felt like, look at this. Spinoza could have remained orthodox if he just hadn't removed himself from the law. Okay.
That's it.
if you knew that, but now he's talking, if you knew that we just had 8 holidays, I guess he's talking about Sukkot, during which, as you know, one does not feel inclined to do anything except to be depressed. Mm. So, he was a...
April 29th, so would have been Pesach.
1757.
April.
He talks about his son. I guess I'm just like, there's a lot more we can say about Moses Mendelssohn. I'm just wondering if this is like a stopping point here, because you get to see a little bit. Here he's talking about his son, and his son is not doing well in his studies. He's not doing well in his studies, and therefore, all right, so he'll do well in the arts and science. Right, he was also, that's right.
Sounds like he could have used a little Hasidus.
Right, but again, what he's doing is his world, He's trying to adapt to the world around him using their sciences and their age of reason. And it's going to have devastating effects because, yes, he in his own...
Oh, he's the prototype.
I think we're going to end with this. This is the one I was looking for. This is what he said. And this really sums up a lot of what his beliefs are. In matters of fundamental... Okay, this was a letter to Levatar, his buddy, his Christian... His enemy buddy. In matters of fundamental religious or ethical convictions, I am a dogmatist. That is to say, I made my decisions and firmly stand on the ground where I believe I can find the greatest measure of truth. Okay, again, where does truth come from? Truth comes from his own mind thinking it through. But when it comes to judging my neighbor, I am a skeptic. That is to say, I have my doubts, for I greatly distrust my ability to convince any man of the truth of my own convictions. No, it's just because I believe in Hashem, and I believe in the Torah, and I believe, I don't think I can convince you to believe. Right? In other words, he didn't think, I came to my understanding because of me. But I don't think I can convince somebody else to actually have all of my beliefs. The more so, since I grant them the same right, I claim for myself the right of free religious choice. Just like I want to have a free religious a choice to be religious or not, he wants to grant the next person to be for religious choice.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And that's, I think that really sums up in terms of in religion what he felt for other people, or what he, it was his own understanding, and that's what led him to believe what he did. I have a number of more slides where I don't know if it was Levatar himself, but others are saying, listen, basically you're a Christian, you're one of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just one more step. And that's it. They said, that's it, you should convert. That's it, you're just one step away from converting. That's what they were telling him. And he ended up writing another massive work called Jerusalem, where he defended Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and his defense of Judaism
like
was somewhat hard, because he himself believed Judaism was archaic. It didn't really, it was not
like
in the right, it wasn't in the age of reason. It just was old and archaic, and they didn't think it through like us thinkers today. So again, he was religious all his life. He had tremendous prominence. In the very beginning, he had rabbis that were following him, that would, you know, give him the, most rabbis were always against him, but he had a few rabbis in the beginning that were like cordial or gave him, I guess, the benefit of the doubt. But I think towards the end of his life, I don't think he was able to, I think all rabbis realized that he was really basically off. His belief system was off. His age, his reason, his understanding of what Torah was and is, and what's going to happen is, because of his prominence, and probably because he was also religious, other people are going to say, "Hey, I can do that too, okay? And I'm going to become a Mendelssohn," and they're going to go pursue the sciences and arts and philosophy and try to absorb themselves in the non-Jewish community, and they're just not going to be able to do what he did. They're not going to stay religious, and their end is going to be assimilation.
That's what happened
too.
Huh?
That happened
too. Yeah, that's what is going to happen to German Jewry, and eventually this age of reason will, not right away, but it's going to make its way east. A lot of it was precipitated or helped with the French Revolution, with Napoleon, when he came east and he brought all his soldiers, and all of a sudden people saw, hey, wait a minute, you know, all these like, you know, people, okay, but that's for another lecture, for sure, Napoleon and the Jews and which sides they took, and if you took the wrong side, but that's, again, another major event that's going to turn over the Jewish world.
Who was it who said he's one step away from being a Christian?
I don't think it was Levatar. I think it was...
Yeah, Levatar. Yeah. I want to see the data there.
think it was on there.
I'm going further because I know, I think I, there it is. There it is.
Yeah.
It was said by anonymously, published, but it was either Joseph von Sonnenfels or by Augusta Friedrich Krohn, the Christian writer and pamphlet here. So basically, and then I think this caused him to put out his new book, Jerusalem, which defended Judaism. All right, next week in Mitzvah Shem, 8:45, we open up with our pizza, and then have to figure out either do I finish with, or do we go and sum it all up and put everything together. All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, so